The headlines: Baghdad is calling for a UN Security Council resolution urging Turkey to withdraw its military forces from all Iraqi territory. The United States says Russia's decision to leave the International Space Station in a few years is unfortunate. And also in our headlines, a powerful earthquake rocks northern Philippines, leaving multiple casualties and a trail of destruction. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half hour. Iraq has asked the UN Security Council to adopt a resolution requiring Turkey to withdraw its military forces from Iraq's territory. Baghdad's request came days after 9 people were killed in artillery strikes in northern Iraq, blamed on Turkey. Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hossein, in an address to the Security Council, called on the UN body to form an independent team to investigate the attack. Members of the Security Council earlier condemned the attack, which took place in Dohuk province of Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region. Iraqi authorities believe that the attack on civilians was carried out by Turkish forces. However, Ankara says its forces did not attack civilians. Turkey has launched a new operation against Kurdish militants holed up in northern Iraq since April. Iran's president has blamed the West for creating crisis in the face of talks to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Ebrahim Raisi said the U.S., the U.K., France, and Germany caused the crisis by submitting an anti-Tehran resolution to the IAEA. He said Iran has adopted a rational and logical approach toward the JCPOA revival negotiations. He said the talks can bear fruit if the West pursues the same approach. The IAEA Board of Governors approved the resolution in June. The motion accused Iran of not cooperating with the agency over its past nuclear activities. Iran condemned the resolution and informed the IAEA that it will disconnect some of the agency's cameras installed under the JCPOA. On Monday, Iran said it will keep the cameras turned off until the deal is restored. And political commentator Abbas Aslani explains why Iran has decided to turn off cameras installed by the IAEA.
Well, Iran tried to keep the cameras in place in order to show good faith. And it also clinched a deal with the IAEA in order to say that it will record the data by the camera. But once the JCPOA, meaning the 2015 nuclear deal, is restored, it will give the data to the IAEA. But on the other hand, the Director General of the agency, they did not react, you know, constructively to Iranian measures. Iran's argument was that as much as Tehran continues to do measures and moves in good faith, but the IAEA responds in a different way, that's why Iran's Atomic Energy Organization decided to stop those cameras from working. But the solution to this problem is very easy. Once all the parties to the nuclear deal, as well as if the U.S. wants to re-enter the deal, if they return to their commitments under the JCPOA, all the things can be resolved very quickly and easily, and Iran can resume its commitments that were, mentioned in the terms of the deal. But the problem is that the other parties and side, including the IAEA, what they do is that they want Iran to fulfill its commitments just in a one-sided road, but they ignore that they themselves also have some other commitments and obligations to do.
The EU's foreign policy chief says the U.S. maximum pressure campaign against Iran that brought the JCPOA to a standstill has been a failure. Josep Borrell, the EU coordinator for the JCPOA revival talks, made the remarks in an article published by the UK-based daily Financial Times. Borrell admitted that despite the failure of the so-called maximum pressure campaign, the Iranian people have been deprived of the full benefits of the deal. Borrell said he has offered a text that addresses the removal of sanctions and other steps needed to restore the JCPOA. Hours later, Iran's chief negotiator, Ali Bagheri-Kenny, tweeted that Iran has its own ideas to conclude the negotiations, both in substance and form, which will be aired. The U.S. Justice Department is conducting a criminal probe into the actions of former President Donald Trump to overturn the results of the 2020 election. U.S. media are citing sources saying that federal prosecutors are questioning former White House officials about Trump's involvement in last year's deadly riots at the Capitol. A congressional committee has been holding its own hearings into the incident. The committee says that Trump should be held accountable for a dereliction of presidential duty. But the panel of senators does not have the power to bring criminal charges against Trump. Therefore, any investigation by the Justice Department into the former president's personal role is very significant. Trump, however, has denied the accusations, calling them total fiction. Russia says it's planning to leave the International Space Station after 2024 as tensions between Moscow and the West escalates over the conflict in Ukraine. The announcement was made by the new head of Russia's space agency, Yuri Borisov. He said Moscow intends to build its own orbiting outpost. He, however, noted that Russia will fulfill all its commitments to its partners in the International Space Station until 2024. The United States has reacted to the plan, calling it an unfortunate development.
It's an unfortunate development given the critical scientific work performed at the ISS, the valuable professional collaboration our space agencies have had over the years, and especially in light of our renewed agreement on spaceflight cooperation.
Price also referred to the soured ties with Moscow, saying although the relations are fundamentally changed, the U.S. still likes to preserve relations in some aspects, including scientific pursuits. The confirmation of the long-mooted move comes as tensions between the Kremlin and the West have mounted over the Ukrainian conflict. The U.S. and its Western allies have imposed several rounds of devastating sanctions against Russia, including its space sector. Well, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russia is using gas prices to terrorize Europeans and deserves to face tougher sanctions.
Among other things, the engineered increase in gas prices to above $2,000 for 1,000 cubic meters on European markets. This is enough of an experience to broaden sanctions against Russia, as it is clear to everyone that this is intended Russian price terror against Europeans. Using Gazprom, Moscow is doing all it can to make this coming winter as harsh as possible for the European countries. Terror must be answered. Impose sanctions.
Russian energy giant Gazprom is planning to reduce gas supplies to Germany to a fifth of its capacity, citing equipment troubles. But European officials believe Moscow is in fact seeking to inflict more pain on Europe for supporting Ukraine. On Tuesday, the EU member states agreed to decrease natural gas consumption by 15% in a bid to reduce dependence on Russian energy ahead of the cold winter months. A powerful earthquake has rattled northern Philippines, causing damage to many buildings. At least four people are confirmed dead, and dozens of the injuries have been reported as well. The 7.1 magnitude quake sent panicked residents rushing into the streets. It has damaged buildings, including heritage sites in Abra and nearby provinces, and caused landslides in some areas. The tremor was even felt more than 300 kilometers away in the capital, Manila, where several buildings were evacuated. Earthquakes are common in the Philippines, but this one was the strongest to hit in years. Seismologists say big aftershocks are expected. Well, in the UK, rail workers launch a fresh strike over pay, job security, and working conditions. The 24-hour walkout by more than 40,000 workers is expected to close half of the country's rail network and cause disruption to millions of people. Passengers are being advised to travel across the country only if necessary. The recent talks between the workers' unions and the employers made no breakthrough. The unions are not satisfied with the pay rise offer, arguing that it does not cover the rising inflation costs. A similar strike in June severely disrupted rail services for 3 days. And the race to replace Boris Johnson as leader of Britain's Conservative Party and Prime Minister heated up when the two candidates, former Finance Minister Rishi Sunak and Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, made their pitches on live television. In a sometimes ill-tempered debate, both candidates were quick to attack each other's record and credibility. Amina Taylor watched the political drama unfold and reports from the British capital.
Dismissed us and it has cost taxpayers 70.
After the warm-up bouts of debates featuring multiple leadership candidates, it was time for the final two to square off in a live televised debate. The head-to-head was the first opportunity viewers, including the estimated 170,000 members of the Conservative Party eligible to vote in the leadership race, could see Liz Truss, Foreign Secretary, face off against former Chancellor Rishi Sunak. Each wasted little time attacking each other's records and credentials and clashed heavily on their individual taxation plans to bring the country out of its worst cost of living crisis in generations.
We are an outlier. Everybody understands that COVID is a 1-in-100-year event, and trying to pay it back straight away, so quickly, that we actually damage our economy, that we end up causing a recession, that we end up in people being out of work, and that hard-working taxpayers who do the right thing have seen their taxes rise, despite the fact that we promised in our manifesto
You just mentioned three countries. Do you know what mortgage rates are in the US at the moment? Do you want to use them as an example? Their mortgage rates are almost 50% higher than mortgage rates in this country because they're borrowing so much.
Canada actually has project fear.
The candidates vying for the country's top job have not shied away from going after each other's political juggler. Some of the exchanges have been brutal, with the former chancellor accused of talking down to his political rival, while Liz Truss has honed in on Rishi Sunak's immense wealth. Now, Tory grandees are fearful that whoever wins this vote, it's actually the Tory party with all of this mudslinging that will be the eventual loser. Former Mayor of London Ken Livingstone has been keenly observing the leadership race. Polls have Rishi Sunak trailing Liz Truss amongst rank-and-file Tory members, and with ballot papers being sent out in early August, both candidates want to build momentum. The results of the leadership ballot will be revealed on September the 5th, still years ahead of a general election that will see the nation have the final say. Amina Taylor, London.
Palestine sympathizers have stormed a firm known for producing parts for Israeli drones and other weaponry in retaliation for Israeli regime aggression against Palestinians in the West Bank. Palestine Action have claimed responsibility for the protests, which saw property belonging to the arms firm damaged and activists detained. Robert Carter headed to the scene to report on the latest.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been raided once again by Palestine supporters, who claim to have inflicted significant damage on the property. The building belonging to UAV Engines was hit last Sunday as part of a wider campaign by Palestine Action activists to harass and hamper the activities of the international arms firm Elbit Systems.
Palestine Action claim that their latest direct action was in retaliation to Israeli regime attacks on the Palestinian city of Nablus in the West Bank on Sunday morning, killing at least two Palestinians and injuring many more. The group also vows that as long as Israeli aggression against Palestine continues, so will their campaign, targeting not just Israeli arms manufacturers in the UK, but also their partners as well.
Following Sunday's action, supporters gathered to protest outside UAV's gates in solidarity with the activists who were detained following the direct action.
The drone parts that are made here are used, are tested on the captive population of Gaza. We know that these drones have killed people, and we're here today to stop the arms trade overall, but specifically against Elbit.
Palestine Action have always said if you continue with this violence against the Palestinian people, then we will retaliate, we will resist, we will come back, we will shut down your factories.
The attack by Israel on Nablus is a common occurrence across occupied Palestine. The lack of action by Western powers to rein in Israeli aggression has inspired more aggressive activism. Palestine Action say their relentless raids have successfully forced the closure of two Elbit sites in London and Oldham. A spokesperson for Elbit acknowledged the incident, claiming it was an attack by a violent group. Although no one was harmed during the raid, Palestine Action's sites remain squarely fixed on UAV engines, so locals can expect more of the same scenes going forward. Robert Carter, Shenstone.
Muslims across the world are preparing to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam Hussein. Afghanistan is widely welcoming the occasion, too. Rahmatullah Bahman reports from Kabul.
Several days ahead of the lunar month of Muharram, people in Afghanistan are preparing to mark the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam and grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Imam Hussein. On Kabul streets, people have held Muharram exhibitions, where they provide necessities for mourning rituals.
We have been holding such Muharram affairs for more than 20 years. We deploy necessities for mourning ceremonies across Afghanistan. However, Muharram always has its own prosperity, but this year it is very different for our people. As we see, people are set to mark a widespread and more passionate Muharram.
Afghans also turn the mosques and public religious places black to express the emotion of grief on the martyrdom anniversary of their third imam.
We are preparing to hold Muharram morning ceremonies in Abul Fazl Shrine. The servants and lovers of Imam Hussein are decorating here with black as an old Afghan religious culture. God willing, we will host a sizable population of mourners during Muharram days, especially in Ashura.
With the Taliban responsible for ensuring security, Afghan Muslims, especially Shias, hope that they can hold their festivities in a peaceful space.
As you know, in the past years, there were security threats, especially by the Daesh terrorist group. Now that the invasion has ended and the Taliban are in power, I hope they tighten the security in advance and provide a safe ground for Muharram mourners across the country. They should cooperate and engage with the people and mourners to foil evil schemes.
Muslims around the globe largely commemorate the Battle of Karbala to keep the spirit of resistance and fight against arrogance alive. They also honor Imam Hussein's sacrifices, renewing allegiance with his ideals.
Every year, millions of people in Afghanistan passionately mourn the martyrdom of Imam Hussein during the month of Muharram. Now here in the capital city of Kabul, preparations are underway for large processions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. U.S. Republicans on House January 6th committee suggest the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas could be compelled to testify voluntarily about her involvement in Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election. We have prepared for you an article written by Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Cheney and Kinzinger Tee Up Possible January 6th Subpoena for Ginni Thomas. House January 6th committee could subpoena Ginni Thomas, the wife of the Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, if she will not testify voluntarily about her involvement in Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election. The news from panel member Liz Cheney came 2 days after Trump's former strategist Steve Bannon was convicted of criminal contempt of Congress for refusing to cooperate with the committee. He now faces time in jail. On Sunday, 24th of July, the second Republican on the committee, Adam Kinzinger, said, "You can't ignore a congressional subpoena or you'll pay the price." A warning, he said, applied to any future witnesses too. Liz Cheney, vice chair of the panel, told CNN's State of the Union program, "The committee is engaged with Ginni Thomas's counsel. We certainly hope that she would agree to come in voluntarily, but the committee is fully prepared to contemplate a subpoena if she does not." Ginni Thomas corresponded with Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's chief of staff, and John Eastman, a law professor who shaped the congressional side of a push which culminated in the deadly Capitol attack. She also corresponded with Arizona Republicans about attempts to overturn Joe Biden's victory in that state. Her activities have added to pressure on her husband. The arch-conservative was the only justice to say that Donald Trump should not have to release records to the House committee. His wife's communications with the Donald Trump camp were subsequently revealed. Some on the left have called for Clarence Thomas to be impeached, a political non-starter. Liz Cheney said, "I hope it doesn't get to a subpoena. I hope Ginni Thomas will come in voluntarily. We've certainly spoken with numbers of people who are similarly situated in terms of the discussions that she was having, so it's very important for us to speak with her." Steve Bannon was convicted after the committee made a criminal referral to the Department of Justice, but in Mark Meadows' case, the Department of Justice declined to pursue charges. Adam Kinzinger told ABC's This Week program, "Those who defy subpoenas should face justice, right? Come in, you can plead the fifth if you want in front of our committee, but you can't ignore a congressional subpoena or you pay the price." Kinzinger added, "That's to any future witnesses too." Elaine Luria, the Virginia Democrat who with Adam Kinzinger presented the committee's case in a hearing on Thursday, 21st of July, told NBC's Meet the Press, "I don't think the Department of Justice can revisit something that they've already dismissed, but Mark Meadows is certainly someone who has probably more information than anyone, you know, other than the folks who we have already heard from who were in the White House on that day." Elaine Luria added, "If he's listening, we'd love to hear from him." Adam Kinzinger said, "He thinks the panel has proved Donald Trump broke the law in his attempts to overturn the election." Liz Cheney would not go so far. She said, "I think that Donald Trump's violation of his oath of office, the violation of the Constitution that he engaged in, is the most serious misconduct of any president in the history of the United States." Liz Cheney added, "The committee has not decided yet whether or not we'll make a criminal referral. I would also say that the Department of Justice certainly is very focused. Based on what we see publicly on what is the largest criminal investigation in American history." She noted, "But there's no doubt in my mind that the former president of the United States is unfit for future office." Elaine Luria said, "I sure as hell hope the Department of Justice has a criminal investigation at this point into Donald Trump." She also said Merrick Garland, the Attorney General, has already told us he's listening, and if he's watching today, I'd tell him he doesn't need to wait on us because I think he has plenty to keep moving forward. The House Committee has held 9 hearings, 8 in the summer run, which ended on Thursday, 21st of July, with almost 3 hours on Donald Trump's inaction while the Capitol was attacked. There will be more hearings in September. Liz Cheney said more interviews were scheduled and the committee anticipates talking to additional members of the president's cabinet. "We anticipate talking to additional members of his campaign." Liz Cheney added, "Certainly we're very focused as well as on the Secret Service." The deletion of Secret Service text messages from 5th and 6th of January 2021, despite an order from the committee to preserve them is another flashpoint. Liz Cheney praised witnesses including Cassidy Hutchinson, a former aide to Mark Meadows, and Sarah Matthews, a former White House press aide. Liz Cheney said certainly it is the case that the attacks against some of the women witnesses have been particularly vicious. I also think the response that we've seen from the House Republicans is really disgraceful. She added, I think our country is at a moment where we really have to all of us take a big step back and say, look, the normal, sort of vitriolic, toxic partisanship has got to stop, and we have to recognise what's at stake. And leadership of the Republicans and the House needs to be held accountable for their actions. Liz Cheney is expected to lose her seat in Wyoming over her opposition to Donald Trump. She would not be fully drawn on whether she plans to run for the Republican presidential nomination in 2024, when Donald Trump is expected to do so. Liz Cheney said, I've not made a decision about 2024, and I'm really very focused on the substance of what we have to do under Select Committee. Very focused on the work and I have to do to represent the people of Wyoming, and I'll make a decision about 2024 down the road. She added, but I do think as we look towards the next presidential election, I believe that our nation stands on the edge of an abyss. And I do believe that we all have to really think very seriously about the dangers that we face and the threats that we face, and we have to elect serious candidates.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistant movement warning of hitting any target in the Israeli-occupied territory. Sadis and Nasrallah has stressed that Hezbollah has sufficient defensive and offensive power at sea. Now, he made that warning as the Tel Aviv regime is embarking on extracting gas from disputed Karish field. And that's while the area is under dispute and there needs to be an agreement with Lebanon before any exploitation of the resources there. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests in today's episode of The Spotlight. Political analyst Karim Shahra is joining us from the Iranian city of Qom. Also with us will be manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, in Toronto.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, Jalameen. Beginning with Karim, as you know, there was this maritime dispute over a couple of blocks in the Mediterranean. The question is, how would it be possible for one party to want to start extracting natural resources of that region that is under dispute?
Well, that's the main problem, actually. That's the entire problem. The whole problem is that the American and Israelis are trying to pressure the Lebanese government into, first of all, accepting Israeli terms, and second of all, they're trying to delay the possible, or Lebanon's possible, possibly benefiting from its oil and gas resources as much as possible, so as to allow the Israelis to begin extraction, while the Lebanese simply can't do anything to bring themselves out of the misfortune and the crisis they are currently living. It's actually, I have no words to describe this. I mean, this is utterly, it's not just inhumane that the Americans are putting so much pressure on Lebanon, but when finally Lebanon actually has a break and can make use of its natural resources in order to bring itself out of this crisis and bring its people a shred of hope, the Americans are just continuing to pile on more pressure and more pressure. People, I'm not sure how, look, it's like, it's exactly what the Lebanese resistance has said so far, what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has said so far. If the Lebanese, if this pressure is meant to keep the Lebanese starving, then that's not going to happen. We will not be starved. We will, I mean, and I'm not quoting, of course, word for word, but the Israelis will be attacked, and we will not starve while the Israelis are allowed to make use of their natural resources. Okay. Or actually, they're stolen by Palestinian natural resources.
Okay, now turning to Toronto, Firas, Israel has not sufficed to its land grab policy in occupied Palestinian land. It's been violating the Lebanese and Syrian airspace and time again to launch air raids, as you know. And now it's trying to plunder other countries' resources at sea. Your take on that?
Yes. I mean, this is only natural because the Zionist regime's establishment was based on stealing and killing and, breaching international law. So it's nothing new, to be honest with you. This is the reality of the situation is that the Israeli regime will continue to violate any laws and to steal as much as they can. And this is also what Sayyid Khamenei also said about the countries that normalize with Israel, that Israel will be, taking advantage of their resources and whatever is left over in their nations. And this is what Israel does from the beginning. It does this inside the land of Palestine that's occupied. We see that, they have so much different areas that they've already controlled and took over, and they're building more and more settlements, and they're even going into the West Bank and trying to take places. And even inside Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah and all these different areas, they keep taking more houses and kicking people out of their houses. And it was clear when that video came out and went out viral when that guy, the neighbor, Jacob, came outside and said that if I don't steal your house, somebody else is going to steal it. So, I mean, this is the nature of the Zionist regime and the Zionist community. Even here in Canada, they act like this, they think like this, they talk like this. When we face off with them in protests and stuff like that, we see that clearly that their mentality anywhere in the world is the same. And that's the problem is because the West gave them a green light to break all the laws and not punish them and penalize them. The United Nations sits there idly watching all these crimes committed, and there's no real punishment, there's no sanctions, there's nothing. And the Israelis now anywhere in the world think that they're above the law and that they can do anything. And this is the problem. And, Hezbollah and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah will not be silent and will not sit idly while the Israelis try to plunder their resources, at this moment.
Yeah. Okay, Karim, let's now talk a little bit about Hezbollah's drone and missile capability. You know, Hezbollah is saying it's able to hit any target in Israel using its own missiles and drones. Your thoughts on that?
Well, actually, this is something that has caused a bit of a ruckus and a lot of confusion within the Israeli military establishment and intelligence establishment. Because, first of all, Hezbollah's drone capabilities have significantly grown over the years, and so have their missile capabilities, and especially their precision missile capabilities. And so they've been trying to, they and the Americans have been trying to send, the Americans mostly, of course, the Israelis through the Americans, have been trying to send a lot of missives throughout the years to Hezbollah to get them to either back down not missile program, but their missile capabilities, and try to give them some concessions in return. But they would not have this, of course, because there's no dealing with the Israelis. I mean, the only language they understand, and so anything that we have gotten so far in Lebanon has been through our use of force. Diplomacy has been utterly unsuccessful with us getting any shred of sovereignty back from the Israelis. So if we just look back at the few months that have passed so far, we can see that the Israelis are not only worried about Hezbollah's drone capabilities. In fact, during their most recent war games close to the north and on the borders with Lebanon, this reflects the state of confusion and the state of constant stress that they're living. I mean, they figured that one of their drones was one of Hezbollah's. They had no idea that this was one of their own drones, and in their state of confusion, they shot at their own drones and even failed to down that same drone, which is theirs.
Right.
The utter state of confusion in Israel and the utter state of fear that they're living because of Hezbollah's advancement in the drone and precision missile field is something that we've never seen before, not to this extent.
Okay.
And this, I believe, reflects the state of easiness or the state of ease that the or how sure the resistance is of its capabilities when it's dealing with an enemy that's so afraid of growing power and its growing potential.
Right. Okay, Fras, what about these differences that there are between the Lebanese side and the Israelis regarding this border demarcation and this maritime dispute? What does it take to remove those differences and come to an agreement? Is it possible?
I mean, this is up to the United Nations if they put pressure and they really want this to be solved, right? If they give the Zionist regime, the open space to and delay the process and play games so Israel can actually plunder the resources and steal the resources, then we're not going to come down to a resolution. And this is the main point. And as it seems, even the person that they used, and appointed to be the mediator between the Lebanese government and the Zionist regime is a Zionist himself. So he's really looking out for the Zionist interests, and he's probably working on the strategy of what the Zionists want. He's not looking for the interest of both parties or, for world peace or for the United Nations Charter of Rights and stuff like this. It seems like the person is himself, as I was reading, I remember reading that he also was part of the IDF at a certain point. So this is obviously not the right person to be appointed in this process. As it seems, it's Israel are already, they've already have their ships over there. I think they are cooperating and collaborating with some kind of Greek company that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has warned them to pull out. So they're already, I think, in the process of, they've already breached the law. They've already, they didn't care about this negotiation, because if they did, everything would be pulled back. And once the negotiation has been complete and they've got down to an agreement, then the next process happens, whether Lebanese go to extract it or the Zionists go to extract it or so on. But right. As it seems, like I said, there's no real resolution and there's nothing that they're really working on to resolve this. So I think the resistance, and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah says that the only way forward is to, confiscate our rights. And that is by resisting and fighting. And he's giving an opportunity, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, I think, is giving a big opportunity to the Lebanese government and to the United Nations and to all the parties to get to resolve this issue before it escalates to a military confrontation. And I know that It's pretty sure that Hezbollah is ready for that. As Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah in his recent interview that he had with Al-Mayadeen, and also the anniversary of the 40th year of the foundation and establishment of Hezbollah. So I think that he's ready for a big confrontation with the Zionist regime, and they know that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Karim, I want to put the same question to you. Do you believe that there is a way out of this, and this maritime dispute could be resolved? And even if it's resolved, how would you guarantee that Tel Aviv will stick to it?
Like your guest said, if the person who's actually mediating for the who's mediating is Amos Hochstein, he's a famed Zionist, and he's siding with the Israelis at all times. He's constantly piling pressure on the Lebanese officials so that they would concede even more territory to the Israelis. Of course, the Lebanese officials would not about to let this happen. And Hezbollah was not about to let Lebanon's sovereignty be desecrated to such an extent.
Mm-hmm.
So the recent statements made by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah before yesterday's interview, these statements actually had the Israelis begging Hochstein to come to Lebanon and try to reach a settlement with the Lebanese side. Like I said earlier, there's no way to discuss anything with the Israelis. So diplomacy, force, and deterrence is the only thing that would have us secure our rights. So when these statements were made, the Hochstein was flying to Lebanon again in order to try to broker a deal with the Lebanese that would fit more with our own interests. But of course, they were not going to concede all the way. And I think a large amount of the statements made by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah yesterday during the interview was meant to deliver a message to the Israelis that, because look, there's a lot of information and confusion in the Israeli military and in intelligence establishment regarding what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said. Some of them are saying that there's a lot to be worried about, and Hezbollah would definitely live up to its promises. And others are saying, well, yes, Hezbollah may have the capability, but it won't risk igniting a war on the front with, or opening a new front with Israel.
Uh-huh.
But even those saying that Hezbollah will not open a new front with Israel are saying that we need to be very careful, because it does have the capabilities to start a new war, mm-hmm. even though it may not want to. So this confusion is driving Hochstein to come to Lebanon again in order to try to broker a deal with the Lebanese side. So
okay.
How will it be resolved? Hopefully, it'll be resolved as per the Lebanese government's requests, meaning that they will abide by the line set by the Lebanese government. And pressure will be taken off foreign companies trying to explore for gas and oil in our fields, because we've had such rounds before. The energy giant Total has been in Lebanon before, and they went to, I believe, Block 9 near the south of Lebanon. It's one of the largest of the blocks. Okay. And and even though we were sure that there was oil and gas there, they were really late giving us the report back, and even when they did give it back, they said there was nothing there. So it was clear that there was a lot of political pressure being piled on Total so that they would give back such a faulty report to the Lebanese officials.
Okay.
So what we're hoping for is that this pressure would be taken off foreign companies so that we would begin exploring for gas and oil.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Firas, given all the points that we've raised so far in this show and discussed, and given the current circumstances, what's the possibility of a war?
I think it's very possible, because the Zionists are very arrogant, and the United Nations never doing its job where it's supposed to broker peace deals and come down to resolutions and respect international law. Certain countries have they have like immunity; they don't have to really follow the laws. So I think, infinitely, the Zionist regime will be taught a lesson by a certain military advancement by Hezbollah, coordinated hopefully with the Lebanese government. And at that point, maybe they will not want to proceed into going into a major war. And knowing they know Hezbollah, they've tested them in 2006 and before that, and you know, in this in the war that was before that when they liberated Lebanon, and they know that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is a very credible man. He's got a very strong support base inside Lebanon, and at the same time, even the Zionist regime call him the al-adu al-sadiq in Arabic. It means the honest enemy. Mm-hmm. They know he's honest. They know he doesn't lie. He doesn't deceive. He doesn't manipulate like them. And that if he says something, he does it. So at the end of the day, they should be prepared for a war, and hopefully, you know, that we can avoid major wars, and we can, you know, claim sovereignty over the resources of the Lebanese country. Hmm.
Karim, we had this Mr. Frederick Hoff. He was a U.S. diplomat in charge of mediation between Israel and Lebanon between the years 2010 and 2012. And he proposed Lebanon to have 55% and to Israel to have 45% of the disputed area, which Beirut at that time did not accept. Was that a fair solution?
Of course that wasn't a fair solution, because if Lebanon was going to have 55%, well, the Israelis already have... look, the thing is, we're going back to square one with this, because if supposedly this would work, first of all, the American side could always pile pressure on the... on foreign oil and gas companies in order to have them constantly delay any work that they're doing. Mm. And so allowing the Israelis, who have already begun extraction, to use these 45% in order to extract whatever they can from the Lebanese side. I mean, they're already stealing our water. They're already stealing any natural resources that we have. So if we share this block, that means effectively that the Israelis will be able to use their already established facilities in order to drain whatever we have from our side. This, of course, isn't going to work. This was just a maneuver in order to get the Lebanese side to feel like they've been able to accomplish something, to claim some sort of victory. It was aimed to allow those in Lebanon who have certain doubts or who are not strong of heart to accept such a political resolution. But this wasn't going to come to pass. The Israelis, like I said, they would have drained us of anything we would have shared with them in that block, and they would have rendered that block, for all intents and purposes, ineffective for the Lebanese side. We wouldn't be able to explore anything.
Mm-hmm. Now, for us, given the plethora of economic woes and issues that Lebanon is already grappling with, how significant is the resolution of this maritime dispute?
Yeah, this Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said at this point, this is one of the most important economical resolutions and solutions for our nation right now, because the embargo is heavy, you know, and all these different countries that are collaborating with the U.S. and Israel are doing their own sanctions against Lebanon in different ways, and they're putting pressures on different politicians, different companies. You know, and they're even, you know, telling their own citizens not to travel to Lebanon and so on, making false claims as if it's a dangerous zone and so on. So it's a very difficult time right now economically for the Lebanese people. And it's a big test and trial, you know, for the Lebanese people and especially for the Lebanese politicians. And I think the only way forward right now is this is an opportunity. This is an opportunity of resources that it can be used to bring in a good amount of, you know, funds and money and so on to help the people of Lebanon, and hopefully it will be shared equally to all the Lebanese people inside Lebanon. You know, it won't go to like one side. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that if Hezbollah was able to, you know, secure these resources and the gas in the maritime, I think that it will be, you know, shared equally inside Lebanon, because Hezbollah cares, the people of Lebanon does not care only about, you know, their people or their supporters or the Shias or so on. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has proven this, that he cares about all of Lebanon, and he's a patriotic person as well. He's a very principled man, cares about the whole region, cares about the security of the region, the sovereignty of the region, and the liberation of Palestine. And we see that consistently with his sacrifices. You know, he sacrificed his son fighting against the Zionist regime and fighting for his land and fighting for the Palestinian cause. where do you find a leader these days that has sacrificed his son fighting the battle? You know, this is very rare. So we have to take all this into consideration.
Okay, on that note, we'll come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had political analyst Karim Sharara in Qom, manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm in Toronto, with her comments and insight. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. This is the end of this edition of The Spotlight.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
As-salamu alayka ya Mawlai Musa ibn Ja'far wa rahmatullah.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now we find that Imam Musa al-Kazim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kadhim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام عونك للضعيف من أفضل الصدقة.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "Your assistance of the weak is one of the best forms of charity."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we talk about the beautiful dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam answered the questions of the people, of his companions, his family members, and his friends. Now, these conversations and these dialogues have been recorded in history, and we find that when Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam spoke with his companions in response to these questions, or when giving a sermon, or when having a conversation, they really talked about a whole host and variety of different things. In one instance, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was comparing a believer to a scale of balance. Now, sometimes, dear friends, we kind of wonder and we question, why is it that we have trials and tribulations and hardships and difficulties in our lives? Sometimes we even think that perhaps these trials and tribulations are a sign that Allah perhaps does not love us, or Allah does not care for us. Or sometimes we become hopeless, or we despair, we become depressed, we become sad, we become frustrated at this fact that we are being faced with trials and tribulations. In this interesting conversation, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam responds and says that a believer is just like the scales of a balance. The more their faith is, the more their tribulations. And so here we find a very interesting point, and that is that when our faith begins to increase, when we start to become closer to the Almighty Allah by means of our worship and our servitude to Allah, we find that trials and tribulations will increase. And of course, the more faith that an individual has, the more trials and tribulations and hardships will come upon the path of life. But this is not something that should dissuade us from continuing the path, because apparently and inwardly, trials and tribulations are a means for us to be able to grow spiritually. They are a means for us to become closer to the Almighty. And as the Holy Quran says, Allah does not burden any soul more than that which its capacity. So the soul has a certain capacity, and depending upon that capacity, Allah puts trials and tribulations. Of course, knowing that the possibility of success and victory is very high, all we have to do is believe and trust in Allah and try our hardest. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Thank you.